I don't know whether to say brethren and sisters or viewers. But anyway, it's nice to be here again. Most people who have written about Ecclesiastes have, in one form or another, argued that the book is a work of skepticism. Well, what does this thesis mean? Well, Greek skepticism is, of course, ancient and, in many ways, very interesting. Because the moment you begin to examine knowledge, problems arise as to what are the objects of human knowledge. What is it that human beings may safely claim to know? And furthermore, what are the limits of human knowledge? What are the things which we cannot expect to know? And how are we going to divide our world of experience into one or other of these two categories? And there are all kinds of possibilities here. And the extreme Greek skeptics said that human knowledge was impossible, that there was no such thing as genuine knowledge, and that all claims to knowledge were ultimately based on delusions, and that man simply misled himself if he thought that the universe was something which he could comprehend, understand, or know. And there were a number of writers who took this line, and they were very determined, they're very hard to refute. There's a thread of skepticism that runs throughout the entire history of philosophy, but in modern times this has narrowed down to religious claims. And many people imagine that skepticism has to do only with claims to know that God exists, for example, or that the Bible is the Word of God, or that Jesus was the Son of God, or that he rose from the dead, or claims of this kind. And modern skepticism has centered exclusively upon problems of religion. But in fact, religious skepticism is only a special version of general skepticism. And general skepticism is concerned with all claims to knowledge, and not simply claims to religious knowledge. And that's important to bear in mind. Now, the point I'm going to argue this evening is that Ecclesiastes is not skeptical in either the Greek or the modern sense. And that is that the writer is not a thoroughgoing skeptic who is doubting all claims to knowledge. Nor is he a modern skeptic who is simply doubting the possibility of religious knowledge. And as you all know, the respectable neutral position today is to be an agnostic and to say, I don't know, in answer to religious claims. It's respectable, it also happens to be sterile and self-defeating. Well then, of what is Ecclesiastes skeptical? And we can answer quite briefly in concepts not available to the writer at the time that he wrote Ecclesiastes, that what he is skeptical of are the claims of secular humanism. That is the claim that the world makes sense or brings satisfaction to man if it is seen as self-consistent and as an end in itself. He is not saying that the world has no sense, but that its sense transcends the world and can only be identified in terms of God. And indeed, a recurring expression throughout the book is under the sun, which is his way of talking about the world. The Greeks spoke about the world, the cosmos. In Hebrew, the writer of Ecclesiastes uses the expression under the sun, the world, and how do we interpret it? And what he is skeptical of in particular are claims to human wisdom, human ambitions, and also religion as a tool of secularism. Let's take these in order. First of all, human wisdom. And here we have three insights. The first is that an examination of life by purely rational means, the rational means available to man, fails to find any satisfactory meaning in life. Repeatedly the writer stresses, everything is vanity. And we know the attempts of many writers to find meaning in life and the curiously unsatisfactory nature of their work. Indeed, modern philosophy has reached the stage where it not only doesn't try to answer that question, but says of the question, what is the meaning of life, that the question itself is meaningless. You can't get any more extreme than that. And this is something which is an important insight of the book of Ecclesiastes. And the second insight is that all events in the world are contained within God's will and can only be understood in those terms. And thirdly, that mere rational inquiry fails to reveal God's will. Look at Ecclesiastes chapter 8 and verse 16. I shall be reading from the Revised Standard Version. Ecclesiastes 8 and verse 16. When I applied my mind to know wisdom, and to see the business that is done on earth, how neither day nor night one's eyes see sleep, then I saw all the work of God, that man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. However much man may toil in seeking, he will not find it out. Even though a wise man claims to know, he cannot find it out. So the claims to discover God and his works by mere rational inquiry are pointless, says Solomon, the writer of Ecclesiastes. You may lose your sleep and work day and night toiling to find the answers. And however satisfied the author may be with the work that he produces, others do not share his satisfaction. Or if they do, not for very long. And the writer makes it plain that an analysis of the social structures of the world fails to determine anything but vanity. And this is interesting because of our passion for the social sciences in the modern world. Surely the scientific view of society will eventually enable us to pin down what it is that leads to social change. Where is the world going? What are the determinants that make for change? And how may they be controlled to the best of human advantage? What, in other words, is the secret of the development of human history? And the social scientist of today is locked in a complex network of investigations that try to elucidate questions like this. And the writer of Ecclesiastes says that if you look at the social structure of the world, you will not find anything but the vanity of the life of man without God. The value of labor is unrelated to any significant gain. Listen to these passages, first from chapter 1 of Ecclesiastes and verse 3. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. Chapter 2 and verse 22. What has a man from all the toil and strain with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of pain, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night his mind does not rest. This also is vanity. A man may dedicate himself to the tasks of this world, break his back, bring sweat upon his brow, toil till his no energy left, and achieve great things, so it might seem. But what is the value of this labor? Nil. Nothing. Vanity. Vexation of spirit. Even if you're an Alexander the Great and you conquer the world and weep because there are no more worlds left to conquer. Death came to Alexander in a drunken fit at the age of 33. What happened to his empire then? It broke up into four pieces, and from those four into many more fragments, until a new empire took its place. What was the gain of all the toil and the labor and the hardship through which Alexander and his men went to achieve a world empire of enormous proportions? And lesser men have toiled to lesser effect, but all is vanity, says the preacher. The distinction between good and evil, between justice and oppression, between righteousness and unrighteousness is not reflected in society. You won't find it there. And those who tell you that morals are simply the reflections of social customs haven't done very much hard work in looking hard at society. Look at chapter 3 and verse 16. I saw under the sun that in the place of justice, even there was wickedness. And in the place of righteousness, even there was wickedness. Chapter 5 and verse 8. If you see in a province the poor oppressed, and justice and right violently taken away, do not be amazed at the matter. For the high official is watched by a higher, and there are yet higher ones over them. Chapter 8 and verse 14. There is a vanity which takes place on earth, that there are righteous men to whom it happens according to the deeds of the wicked, and there are wicked men to whom it happens according to the deeds of the righteous. I said that this also is vanity, and this is how society is structured. It's a hierarchy of inequities, of injustices, of inequalities. The young, when they first discover this, are horrified. And the young, an active university student, wants to put the world right by some violent means, wants to right the wrongs of society. And the harder he works, the more he comes to realize, or should do, that all is vanity. The attempts on the part of man to put right these structures are doomed to failure. We replicate the evils that belong to each one of us. The writer makes it plain that the attempts by men to predict the future, whether by divination, the use of horoscopes, or futurology, or even economic forecasts, they sound respectable, don't they? All the vanity, all the vexation of spirit, none of them get you any further forward in understanding what is to come. Listen to the economists as they come on the box night after night and say, well, of course, the gold standard is doing this, the economy is doing that. In a few months' time, just jot it down on paper and wait for a few months, and then listen, well, of course, we weren't quite right about this. Not half they weren't. Look at what they said a few months before about the economy in the new year, and you see it's all wrong, and they're completely baffled. They might as well look at the liver or cast bones, as our Zulu brethren do, for all the value of the economic forecast as an accurate determinant of human destiny. All this is vanity. Listen to how the writer puts it in chapter 8 and verse 6. Every matter has its time and way, although man's troubles lie heavy upon him, for he does not know what is to be. For who can tell him how it will be? chapter 10 and verse 14. A fool multiplies words, though no man knows what is to be, and who can tell him what will be after him? Nobody knows, and certainly the efforts by human beings to plumb the mysteries of the future, by whatever means they devise, turn out in the end to be self-defeating. And all human action, says the writer, takes place in the shadow of death. The famous passage that we know so well from chapter 3 and verse 19. The fate of the sons of men and the fate of beasts is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath, and man has no advantage over the beasts. For all is vanity. The common fate awaits us all, man and beast alike. All of the actions which we play out, the charade that we live, is lived in the shadow of death. Now this, of course, is not the thesis that the world is accidental and fortuitous. The point that is being made is that it is God who is supreme. It is God who rules and orders events. Everything has its time and its place, which is determined by God independently of human efforts. Look at chapter 9 and verse 11. Again, I saw that under the sun the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to the intelligent, nor favor to the men of skill, but time and chance happen to them all. For man does not know his time, like fish which are taken in an evil net, and like birds which are caught in a snare, so the sons of men are snared at an evil time when it suddenly falls upon them. Chapter 3 and the opening verses. These beautiful words. For everything there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven. A time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to break down and a time to build up. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to seek and a time to lose. A time to keep and a time to cast away. A time to rend and a time to sow. A time to keep silence and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. A time for war and a time for peace. What gain has the worker from his toil? Verse 14 of the same chapter. I know that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. God has made it so, in order that men should fear before him. That which is already has been. That which is to be already has been. And God seeks what has been driven away. Chapter 7 and verse 23. All this I have tested by wisdom. I said, I will be wise, but it was far from me. That which is far off, and deep, very deep. Who can find it out? God God's activity, says the writer, is beyond human wisdom. What God does endures, in contrast to the vanity and the vexation of spirit, which is the result of human effort. Let's turn now to human ambitions. What are human ambitions? What kinds of things do men desire? Well, they desire health, they desire wealth, they desire power, they desire fame, they may desire the admiration of women, they seek for pleasure. And these things might be a blueprint for a humanist philosophy. Let's examine them each in turn. Health. What an obsession this has become in the modern world. We have health clubs. We have endless health diets. We have any number of faith healers who offer to shorten one leg if it's too long, or lengthen the other if it's too short, or perhaps pull our legs simultaneously at the same time. But they're not to be taken terribly seriously, because they've substituted the search for union with God, for the search for union with God, they place instead the desire for bodily health and strength, which, however desirable it may be, profiteth little, says the apostle. And we read those beautiful words from chapter 12 of Ecclesiastes about the consequences of growing old. The need to remember one's Creator in the days of one's youth, before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened, in the day when the keepers of the house tremble and the strong men are bent, the doors on the street are shut and the sound of the grinding is low, before the silver cord is snapped, or the golden bowl is broken, or the pitcher is broken at the fountain, or the wheel broken at the cistern, and the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. And those who dedicate their lives to pursuing health are fighting a losing battle, and the marks of their mortality are evident upon them. And what about wealth? Well, we live in a generation that perhaps more than any other assiduously worshipped mammon. Mammon is a thing to be worshipped. We even build temples to mammon. We don't build decent churches anymore with marble pillars and great lofty halls. That's a thing of the past. The only decent buildings put up these days are banks. And you go in and there you see these beautiful colonnades and these high ceilings and all the murals which the skilled artists can produce. And these are temples to mammon. They give you a sense of solidity, a sense that your money here is safe, and if your money is safe, your future is safe, and your future is guaranteed. How ridiculous. Listen to what the preacher says in chapter 5. Verse 10. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with gain. This also is vanity. Verse 13. There is a grievous evil which I have seen under the sun. Riches were kept by their owner to his hurt, and those riches were lost in a bad venture. And he is a father of a son, but he has nothing in his hand. As he came from his mother's womb, he shall go again, naked as he came, and shall take nothing for his toil, which he may carry away in his hand. This also is a grievous evil. Just as he came, so shall he go. And what gain has he that he toiled for the wind, and spent all his days in darkness and grief, in much vexation and sickness and resentment? Chapter 6 and the first verse. There is an evil which I have seen under the sun. and it lies heavy upon men. A man to whom God gives wealth, possessions and honour, so that he lacks nothing of all that he desires. Yet God does not give him power to enjoy them, but a stranger enjoys them. This is vanity. It is sore affliction. This is what happens to your money. You can't take it with you, is the old saying. You leave it to your children, who may well all of them be idiots. And if they're not idiots and you're lucky and they turn out to have a fount of wisdom that you did not suspect in them when they were young, what about their children? Eventually the line will produce a series of idiots, you can be sure of that. And your business empire, your title, your lands, whatever it is, will be dissipated by some foolish man or woman who doesn't know how to handle an estate or whatever it is, in whose fingers money simply burns and who fritters it all away. What value is this? Why are you spending your life striving for this? To leave it to another who will not appreciate the labour which has gone into achieving this. And what a power! How human beings love power. They strive for it. It's one of the greatest things that men strive for. Listen to what Ecclesiastes says in chapter 2 and verse 9. I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me. And whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done, and the toil I'd spent in doing it. And behold, all was vanity, and a striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. Verse 18. I hated all my toil in which I had toiled under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he'll be a wise man or a fool? The chances are he'll be a fool. Yet he'll be master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity. The quest for power. Some men achieve it, and they ride the crest of a wave for a few years, and then their end comes, often before their actual death, preceded by a fall from power, a crumbling of all that on which they had built, on all that in which they had hoped, and in which they had trusted. It all comes to nothing. And what of fame, of reputation, the desire to be thought well of by one's contemporaries, whoever they may be? Well, look at chapter 1 and verse 10. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It has been already in the ages before. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to happen among those who come after. If you achieve originality in your chosen field, there's a flock of young men willing to write books to show that your originality was not really original, but derived from people who preceded you. And when they've finished and these books have passed into history, your own work will be forgotten as quickly as theirs will be. And in the end, there's no remembrance of it anymore. It doesn't pay off. Chapter 9 and verse 13. I have also seen this example of wisdom under the sun, and it seemed great to me. There was a little city with few men in it, and a great king came against it and besieged it, building great siege works against it. But there was found in it a poor wise man, and he by his wisdom delivered the city. Yet no one remembered that poor man. But I say that wisdom is better than might, though the poor man's wisdom is despised and his words are not heeded. Here is the fruit of fame. The poor wise man who delivers the city is a celebrity for a brief moment and then is quickly forgotten. Chapter 12 and verse 12. My son, beware of anything beyond these, of making many books there is no end, and much study is a weariness of the flesh. And we have the syndrome in our academic world now of publish or perish. And you publish, and you make sure that your books are read by prescribing them to your students. But what happens when you're no longer in a position to prescribe them to your students? They moulder on the shelves in the library and gather dust. There's no future in that either. The fame that they bring is transient. It doesn't achieve anything. It doesn't bring satisfaction. It doesn't bring that satisfaction to man's deepest inner needs. This is what the writer is saying all the time. And we need to be saying these things to the humanists in our world today. And what about beautiful women? Who knew more about beautiful women than Solomon? He was an expert in this field. Listen to these words, clearly belonging to his old age. Chapter 7 and verse 26. I found more bitter than death the woman whose heart is snares and nets, and whose hands are fetters. He who pleases God escapes her, but the sinner is taken by her. Chapter 9 and verse 9. Enjoy life with the wife whom you love. All the days of your vain life which is given you under the sun, because that is your portion in life, and in your toil at which you toil under the sun. This is an interesting passage and illustrates again the difficult. Let me go back to chapter 7 and read on from verse 27. Chapter 7 and verse 27. Behold, this is what I found, says the preacher, adding one thing to another to find the sum, which my mind has sought repeatedly, but I have not found. One man among a thousand I found, but a woman among all these I have not found. That's an interesting and perhaps cynical conclusion of an embittered man. And what of pleasure? We live in a society bent on pleasure, believing in pleasure and almost making it into a religion. Listen to what Solomon has to say in chapter 2 and beginning at verse 1. I said to myself, come now, I will make a test of pleasure. Enjoy yourself. That's the motto of the world today. Enjoy yourself. That's the thing to put up outside all the sports stadia in the country. And all the inside sports halls, or enjoy yourself. You deserve it. This is what Solomon set out to test empirically. Does pleasure bring satisfaction? Does it bring happiness? Are those who seek this pleasure men who have found peace? Well, look at the behaviour of Manchester United supporters when they're abroad. If their team happens to lose, they set about systematically destroying the town. If they don't lose and they win, they get so drunk they don't even know that they're destroying the town. But either way, the police have a serious riot problem on their hands. These are people who are looking for pleasure. And Solomon says, let's try it. Let's make a test of it. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad. And of pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my body, with my mind, how to cheer my body with wine. My mind still guiding me with wisdom. He chose the brands very carefully. And how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was good for the sons of men to do under heaven during the few days of their life. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I had also great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, man's delight. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in my toil, and this was my reward for my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done, and the toil I'd spent in doing it, and behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. Every facet of human experience, apart from religious experience, is carefully explored in the book of Ecclesiastes and shown to be wanting, not to bring satisfaction, not to be in man's best interests, but simply a snare and a delusion. And lastly, the third division, religion as a tool of secularism. We are all well aware, acutely aware, of the danger of making religion into a kind of icing on the cake, of where you serve mammon in this life, and you get the best that is going for you in this life, and you look to religion as the icing on the top. Or to change the analogy, we look upon religion as being an insurance policy. We get all that we can from this life. We seek pleasure and wealth and fame and riches and whatever it may be that our hearts desire after. We search for mammon and seek and worship mammon rather than God. And yet we hope that in the end it will all turn out right and that religion will prove to be to our ultimate salvation. That view of religion was the greatest problem of religion in Israel's time and is certainly prevalent today amongst all kinds of churches and all manner of churchmen and churchwomen. It's a very tempting and easy way of looking at religion. It is, of course, a totally facile, optimistic way of looking at things. And Scripture makes it evident again and again that you cannot serve God and mammon. And that the idea that you can use religion as a way of buying your way into God's favour in the future whilst ignoring him at the present, this is a contradiction in life which God abhors. And the prophets of Israel, one after the other, denounced this attitude. That you could do as you like now, observe the ritual ordinances of religion, and then hope that all would turn out well in the end. And one particular doctrine is attacked by Ecclesiastes. Look at chapter 3 and verse 21. How many churches are there who tell us that the spirit of man goes up and the spirit of the beast goes down? How many religions are there founded upon this doctrine? And the skeptical preacher asks, who knows whether the spirit of man goes upward and the spirit of the beast goes down to the earth? He knows already that man is like the beast that perishes, that all go to the one place. And the facile hope offered by those who say, but you're going to go to bliss forever the moment that you die, as opposed to the beasts who perish. Who knows this? What evidence have they got? He's rightly sceptical of this claim. And in its place he says, man is like the beast that perishes. All go to one place. All are of the dust and all turn to dust again. Now look at 1 Kings chapter 4, because this is a passage that throws important light upon the man that wrote this book. First Kings 4 and verse 29. And God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding beyond measure, and largeness of mind like the sand on the seashore, so that Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the people of the east and all the wisdom of Egypt, for he was wiser than all other men. Verse 32. He also uttered 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. He spoke of trees, from the cedar that is in Lebanon to the hyssop that grows out of the wall. He spoke also of beasts, and of birds, and of reptiles, and of fish. And men came from all peoples to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom. So here is a man who, in modern parlance, we would describe as an eminent philosopher, a distinguished scientist, a musician of considerable versatility, a literary man whose proverbs we have, many of them preserved in the sacred text of Scripture itself. He was all of these things and more. His wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all other men. Here then is a man who spoke from experience. And when he spoke of the vanity of human life, as it is lived without God, he knew exactly what he was talking about. Every field of human endeavor had been tried by Solomon with great brilliance, with great expertise. His public works alone, his economic gifts, his public gardens, parks, and so on, all the rest of it, his organized force of labor was a considerable achievement for the world in which he lived. In all these things he was thoroughly expert and at home, and yet all turned to ashes, all turned to something which did not bring him satisfaction, or peace of mind, or tranquility. And he passes on this information to others from his vast personal experience, from the greatness of his wisdom. And indeed we will be rightly envious of a man of that caliber who lived in the world today. We would all admire him and revere a man of such wide diversity of gifts and wisdom. And yet this man repeatedly shows that life without God is vanity and vexation of spirit. That only God is eternal. Only God's will and God's works have any permanence about them. And that we need to surrender ourselves to God as instruments in his hand and let him work within us if we are to achieve the satisfaction and peace and tranquility that man so desperately longs for.